Igabo Chipande, who will be doing his doctoral dissertation on the history of football in Zambia in colonial and post-colonial times. We also have a bunch of people online, but I think in the interest of time and efficiency, maybe folks will introduce themselves as they speak or as they ask their questions. And I thought we could divide the meeting up into three parts. Basically, in the first part, there'll be the very short presentations by myself, Alon, Tom McCabe, Stephen, and Sean on our courses. And then in part two, we'll have the Q&A about the syllabi. And then part three, we'll just completely open the floor and discuss any matters of interest. And I hope we'll have enough time at the end for a couple of minutes to talk about the schedule for spring of 2012, since this is the last meeting scheduled for 2011. So does that sound good with everyone?
Sure.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So the course that I've been teaching recently is entitled Global Soccer, History, Culture, and Politics. And I hope you've looked at the syllabus. I just wanted to share a couple of items about it. First of all, obviously, you can teach football in a whole number of ways and from many different disciplines. So why global football history? And my cheeky answer is that there are already other colleagues who teach the history of sex, the history of drugs, and the history of rock and roll. So all the good topics were taken, so I went to football. On a more serious note, it is a upper-level advanced undergraduate seminar. It's one of the two required seminars. The other one is an introductory course in our major. So this is a sort of senior research seminar that's aimed at honing students' historical skills by undertaking their own research project. And that's why I have the chunky research paper at the end. Okay. And we have various 480s. I'm doing the one in comparative history, basically world history. And my definition of world history follows closely Patrick Manning's definition. And that is to say that there's an emphasis on connections across people, across areas, that we tend to think as usually separate or disconnected. And the first time I taught a course like this was actually 15 years ago at a seminar at Tufts University in the Boston area. I was still a graduate student, and there were really many, many fewer books to teach with. And I just looked over my syllabus, and I assigned a lot of articles. And the only thing that came close to being a global text was James Walvin's The People's Game from the mid-70s that had recently been reissued, and that's really focused on Europe. And then Tony Mason, Passion of the People, and a couple of other things. So, you know, we're very lucky now. We have a plethora of sources that we can use, and I try to do that in a way that's attractive to students. But also, I treat the soccer course very much the same way I treat all my courses, and that is, you know, I think about coverage in terms of chronology, in terms of themes, in terms of geography. The texts and assignments that I try to pick are a combination of kind of classics and cutting edge stuff. Their readability and relative low cost is important to me because I want students to be able to buy all the books. And they should fit in sort of in the rhythm and flow of the class. I also have an angel site, which is kind of like Blackboard or Moodle, if anyone's familiar with those, where I have a lot of additional resources that don't make their way onto the syllabus. For example, videos, oral sources, podcasts, you know, David Goldblatt's radio documentaries, and other juicy stuff, soccer-themed commercials, recommended readings, all sorts of other stuff. And the challenges, I guess, that I found teaching this particular course is that as a world history course and being based in the U.S., it's much more difficult to find primary sources, which, of course, are key for historians, for students who are interested in doing work outside of the United States and Canada. So, you know, how can you really truly do world history if you're doing research papers that tend to rely a lot on secondary sources? Doing genuinely global history outside the Western core, in other words, is very difficult, and I struggle with that a lot. Also, the collaborative learning aspect of my course tends to have uneven results. Alex was great. He did a Zotero group library for the course last time I taught it, and also showed students how to use Zotero. And, you know, honestly, as much as we tried, very few students took advantage of it. And it was somewhat disappointing in that respect. On the plus side, when students did presentations on their research papers and they got some peer review, they did very well with that and integrated a lot of the feedback into their final drafts. So I'd like to find ways to enhance that collaborative learning a little more. So that's really all I want to say. And why don't we just move along then and turn to Alon, if you're there. Alon, are you online? No, okay, Alon is not with us yet. So why don't we turn to Tom?
Yes, hello. Can everybody hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I've been lucky enough to teach a version of this course three times, and once as a seminar, and then twice as an undergraduate survey course in global history, and then I'll teach it again this summer. So I've taught it three times during the summer, which presents some of its own issues, which I'll discuss a little bit later. I always like to call it a dream course, and probably like many of you who have taught these, it's somewhat difficult to get them on the course docket. I was denied three times by the department chair who didn't think soccer was a viable area of study. So I like Peter's comments of history of drugs, history of rock and roll. This fellow was a film historian, so I really understand the prejudice. But after some trial, we got the course kicked off, and I modeled it, not oddly enough, I guess appropriately enough, after Peter's course, because I had a copy of that syllabus from Tufts all those years ago after we first met at a academic conference. So I had filed that away and always wanted to teach this course. And like Peter, there are more syllabi and books out there now. So if you're designing one of these for the first time, you're probably in a much better spot than he was and then where I was a handful of years ago. So basically, it's a global history of soccer. I'm an Americanist. I'm not a global historian, so I had to kind of fake and fudge some of that. We essentially tried to tour the world with chronology and themes and topics as our boundaries and our guides. And it was listed by the department as a topic in transnational history, which if you're trying to get this course taught, I would suggest you use a name that's already on the course registry that just fits your topic. I mean, it's, you know, topics in transnational history. Global History of Soccer is the subtitle. So we covered a lot of ground, and we used the kind of case study model as we move from continent to continent to follow the global diffusion of the game. And when we stopped and lingered, we looked specifically at the issues of race, class, gender, nationalism. You know, I would bring in the sense of, say a historian like Robin Kelly, the iron triangle of race, class, and gender, and which one do you prioritize or privilege? And then we throw in other categories to look at. So from the historical angle, I was trying to teach them to use those instruments, use those tools that historians use on a regular basis. Some of the things that really worked, I like to use, soccer as local history. And in the first week, I got them on a bus, one of those campus tour buses, and we went around to the different historical spots that meant so much to the American game in Kearney, in Harrison, and in Newark. And then later in the semester, we visited one of the local ethnic immigrant clubs. And talk to people there about the game and immigrant culture and immigration and work and community and religion, all those great topics to explore. I'm probably like some of you at a university that's really unique. Rutgers University, Newark is the most diverse university in the country, perhaps the world. So we had students from everywhere in the course. So they brought a lot of the global history, their history in with them. Also emphasized, you know, some short writing assignments, in particular what I called create assignments. It's the last page of the syllabus where I wanted them to get out of the classroom and act as kind of a participant observer, anthropologist, commentator, and experience the game. So one student went to watch a World Cup qualifier at Nevada Smith's in New York. Another fellow showed up at an Italian-American social club in North Jersey and had coffee with Italian men and watching the Serie A. It wasn't Tony Soprano, of course, but others did, you know, a thick description of their own involvement in the game. One person talked about a real pay-for-play affair where he scores the winning goal in an underground soccer game where the winner takes all the money and some fan comes out and smashes him over the head with a Corona bottle. Or on a more touching level, how a daughter and her father, you know, through the course and through experiencing soccer together, you know, kind of brought them back from an estranged relationship. Some of the challenges, time. We met 4 days a week, Monday through Thursday, for close to 2 hours. So it was a lot of time. And the students had trouble keeping up with the frequency of the reading and the amount of the reading. And we did use Goldblatt's book. But I tried to emphasize to them that this thing's cut up into distinct compartments, if you will, case studies, you know, examples, you know, moving from, you know, one locale to another, all in the course of a 3 or 4 part chapter. So that was a big issue for me. And that's where I'll stop. I know I'm close to my limit here. I'll let the next person talk. But just a dream course and, you know, so much fun doing it.
Great. Thanks, Tom. So let's then move on to Stephen Apostolov. Where are you joining us from, Stephen?
Hi, Peter. I'm actually in Quincy, Massachusetts at this time. I was a couple of months ago in London for the annual conference of the British Society of Sports History. It was a great conference. Met in person Matt Taylor. I think you met before that in Germany somewhere.
Yes.
So thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk about my course and to exchange some ideas with you guys. In a similar fashion as you did, I taught my first soccer course at Tufts University. It was the first time it was in 2008. And I was lucky actually to teach a course that was my dissertation was actually presented in a course format. They usually change the title whenever you apply. I wanted to have a different title, but they changed it to a Soccer Society and Immigration. And my dissertation was basically a case study of Massachusetts in which I analyzed the popularity of soccer through the scope of immigration. It was a great experience. And now let's switch a little bit and talk about the course. The one that I sent you, the syllabus. Originally, the course was designed in 2010, and I taught it just before the World Cup. So it was literally filled up in 4 seconds. In 4 seconds after the first 4 seconds after registration opened, I started having emails, requests for overdraft. And I, my heart was broken because I had to turn down a lot of kids, and some of them were – it was there last year. So it was a very popular course. The course was open to students from a wide – and by the way, let me add that, as I said, originally the course was titled The World Cup Soccer History and Politics. Currently, it is offered at UMass Lowell in the Department of Political Science. They changed the title to Soccer and Politics. It's an online course, so I had the opportunity to teach the same course conventionally in a classroom face-to-face, and now I teach it online. The course is open to students from a wide range of academic backgrounds. The course offers an interdisciplinary approach to analyzing the development of the World Cup from its inception.
Hi, Sean.
In 1930 in Uruguay. Hello?
Yeah. Keep going, Stephen. Sorry.
Somebody turned his microphone and there is echo. So let me repeat. The course offers an interdisciplinary approach to analyzing the development of the World Cup from its inception in 1930 in Uruguay up until the World Cup in South Africa. The primary goal of the course is to provide students with rich empirical information along with theoretical perspectives through which to comprehend the evolution of the tournament and its effect on society. The course also seeks to arm students with tools to analyze the modernization and commercialization of soccer through the prism of the World Cup. And by the end of the course, students are usually able to analyze the 18 World Cup tournaments and put them into context in terms of politics, economics, culture, and history. Now, let me go. Let me talk a little bit about the methods that I use. I really like introducing movies and snippets of a lot of documentaries throughout the course. Because it's very difficult, especially at Tufts. I found it very difficult. As Peter knows, courses are taught at 6 or 6:30, and they're taught once per week for 2.5 hours. It's very, very difficult to have this undergrad students focused for 2.5 hours. So that's why I introduced this snippets or documentaries to change the rhythm a little bit. And for instance, my lecture... The lecture on the World Cup in England, which is, I think, lecture 4 of the online course. I have a very short lecture. I talk about the Cold War, and all the students have to do is to watch the great documentary, The Game of Their Lives, and write a movie review after that, and they love this assignment. So that's how I change a little bit the rhythm. The way it works... Every week, the students answer the weekly questions, and they have to do a 50% with the lecture, and also introduce Sports Business Journal. There is a weekly drill on the Sports Business Journal, so they have to read the issue and answer some questions. And every other week, they have to write a book review. And since the course is intensive, we're about to finish. It's our week 10. This week, they have to write a book on Peter Legge's book, African Soccerscapes. And their final... is a movie review. They have to choose a movie from a list and write a movie press here. So we're almost over because it's an intensive course, accelerated 10-week. Now, let me talk a little bit. I'm glad that Tom brought this issue. So obviously, there is a lot of prejudice about soccer-related courses. I was lucky, actually, the former chairman of the political science department at the University of Massachusetts. He's a sports fan. He's been teaching a course, sports and politics, for almost a decade. He liked my course at Tufts. He invited me with Frank Dalapa, the reporter from the Boston Globe, to co-teach this course there. Fortunately, there was a coup d'etat in the department. There is a new chair now who doesn't like sports, and he unfortunately canceled a lot of courses. Our course is still there, but I think that my days are numbered. So that's about it. Let me just give back the word to Peter, and thank you again for giving me this opportunity to present my course.
Let's pass on to Sean Jacobs from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you? You can hear me, right?
Yes, beautifully.
So basically, I teach a course called Global Soccer, Global Politics in a master's program in international affairs at the New School. So let me just say something quickly about that. It's a 2 years master's program in a it's interdisciplinary, and it has a number of concentrations. It's sort of the equivalent of having a major. So they have development, cities and urbanization, governance and rights, and one other. Conflict and security, and then they have media and culture, which I chair. So the global soccer, global politics is situated in this media concentration, but it students who are taking the other concentrations, they also take the course. So the aim, it's a very weird kind of graduate school. It's a terminal master's, meaning, if you want to go to school again, you have to start for grad school, you have to start again with a master's if you want. So, and the idea is to mix theory and practice. It's kind of like something like the Kennedy School or SAIS at Johns Hopkins or, you know, CEPA at Columbia. It's that kind of thing. So it's not entirely just very academic or theoretical. There's also sort of a practical part to it. At the New School itself, kind of talking about soccer, taking soccer seriously or using soccer or, you know, through soccer to talk about globalization or the nation state or identity politics or media or the economy is something, it's something new. I mean, there have been people at the New School before who there are people who study football. So Jeho Kang, who's in the media studies department, he looks at sport and spectacle, the kind of the Olymp, you know, these big sort of, so the World Cup would be treated as part of this, the Olympic Games, the World Cup, the Super Bowl. And Barry Salmon, who's the head of the media studies department, he has a sort of literary interest in football, but that's about it. So this is a completely new direction at the New School. The next thing is, this is my first time doing this. I've never taught about football, but I was born in South Africa. And I grew up with football, you know, it's like second nature. I'm not a great football player, but, you know, I've always been interested in football, and I've always thought about football as some, as a way to think about other things, but I've never really done it, right? And this is part of sort of something, kind of my own research interest, which moved away from studying media and policy debates about politics to looking at media, popular media. So I currently, I'm trying to finish a book on reality television and soap operas as it relates to change and political change in South Africa. And from that, I began to think more and more about football. So I teach the course, and just quickly, I'm going to run through this. I co-teach it with another professor, Tony Karen, who's an adjunct in our department. He's a journalist at Time. If you want, you can Google him. He's written for Time about football, especially for the global, I forget the word, the blog's name is it's a global spin. And during the World Cup, they had a lot of blogging and writing on the World Cup. And Tony, along with some another writer at the time called Isan Tarur, they wrote a lot of football-related articles. Also on his blog, The Rootless Cosmopolitan, he writes about football. If you look at the course, I mean, it's pretty, you know, straightforward. And I mean, for those who've looked on the Football Scholars website, basically the way we treat it is to think about this kind of, you know, football's now in this kind of globalized, like everybody's watching the English, well, mostly people are watching the English Premier League. Like, why is that happening? If you're looking at it from the United States, where up until recently, you know, football was there, but it wasn't taken very seriously by commerce, by sort of, if you want, the media class. Suddenly with the 2010 World Cup, ESPN is investing all this money. For the next World Cup, you have Fox, you know, getting the rights to broadcast the World Cup here. I'm talking mainly about English, the sort of English people who watch the World Cup in English or watch football in English. So we try to use it to talk then about a range of issues, migration, identity, globalization, you know, political conflict. The way we structure the class is when we open, we usually talk about stuff that happened in the week. And like, I think it was Stephen who spoke earlier, we also make use of a lot of video material. So YouTube, having an internet connection in the class comes in very handy. We make use of articles that, so in the prescribed articles, we use a mix of kind of like long form journalism, sort of more academics writing about football, and then writers, you know, kind of sports, like the sports journalism, that would be sort of the third leg of it. The assignments are, you know, for the first part, because it is a media-driven course, they write a film review. They write a review of a movie that deals with issues around football. That's almost like a midterm. They just finished that where they, you know, we provide them with a range of titles, and if they want to write about something that's not on the list that we include, then they can come up with their own titles. So it would be something like Bended Like Beckham, The Miracle in Bern, you know, the movie about the cosmos, et cetera, et cetera. The final project, and this is slightly where because of the nature of the school, they have to actually make a short media, like a piece of media. So it could be an audio documentary or it could be a film documentary. These are like 5 minutes. And with all other classes at the new school, these are posted online, so they are public. Some of the projects, just quickly, that some people are proposing is someone's going to look at this is an American guy whose father's from Spain, and he's interested in looking at some of his relatives and how they are experiencing football while living in America. So he's going to, his wife's family's from Haiti, his brother-in-law is from Brazil, and of course his father is from Spain, and he's going to, the way that he's going to connect this is about football under a dictatorship. So Haiti under Duvalier when they go to the World Cup, Spain under Franco with his, you know, father, and with Brazil during its dictatorship. So I think there's this kind of, people think about, you know, themes, and then they link it up with sort of more broader questions. Like, who comes to the class? It's a mixture of people. I mean, of course, there are usually three or four people whose parents are from somewhere else, or who grew up, you know, often in the ones that are in the class grew up in Europe, or so an Armenian refugee who grew up in Sweden, or a Sierra Leonean student who came here as a teen. You have, as I said, people whose parents are immigrants, and then you have people who are interested in sport, and sport as a way to think about social questions. The final comment I was going to make, and then I'll shut up, is it's been, I mean, one of the things we've done, if you look at our syllabus, is we actually put up sort of a set of questions before the class, you know, we put it on the syllabus. And so when people turn up for the class, they have sort of a framework of what we're going to discuss that week. In that first week, we did not discuss, we didn't do any readings, but after that, we do kind of a maximum or a minimum of something like 40, 50 pages. And then my final remark is, I actually relied a lot on the syllabi that I requested from people like Laurent, Chris Balsman, Martha, and Peter. So anyway, I'll stop there. I can answer or talk a little bit more about what it is to do this as a first-timer. Thanks.
Okay. All right, then let's open up the floor for the first round of questions. And since there are quite a few of us in the conversation, could we please have, you know, one question at the beginning from people rather than more than one? Who would like to start?
How about, can you hear me? This is Martha.
Yes, Martha. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I have a question, and it's not going to be about women, although that's I could. But the question I have is, many of us coach, and you know, the very specific technical aspects of football. I found, like Peter, in some of your work, looking at you know, the development of people learning the game and how they learn the game, and you know, different formations or learning different techniques. That also has an impact on the social aspects, historical aspects of the game. And I'm wondering how people have been able to include that and tackle that within their courses.
Let's take another couple of questions, and then we'll sort of try to generate some conversation and tie the questions together. Next question.
This is Tom, and I'd love to hear from David Goldblatt on how we can best use his opus in a history of soccer class.
Okay, let's take a third one, and then we'll begin the chat, the dialogue. Anyone?
Peter, just maybe a quick observation. Stephen Apostolo from Quincy, nearby Boston. I was surprised when I saw the description of the courses and the word politics is omnipresent. I mean, it's politics are political. And I want to put it in a context with the World Cup in Russia and in the Middle East, in Qatar. Wolfgang, I actually have something to chew on for many decades to come.
Excellent. Okay, so let's maybe start with my question, which I think is really interesting one on a whole number of levels. I'll just put my two cents in, because I think it speaks to several of the points that folks mentioned. For example, the fact that when we teach these courses, they're often quite popular with students, ranging again from the fantasy soccer geeks to the complete neophytes who get caught up in, say, you know, the World Cup that's happening in the here and now. But also speaks to kind of the prejudice that a lot of intellectuals across the disciplines still hold against topics like soccer, which I find quite incredible, given the dull topics that so many well-established intellectuals do deal with and have built brilliant careers on. It also speaks to the balance that I find very necessary between what happens on the playing fields and what happens outside the playing fields. There's a tendency among scholars, I think, to focus maybe a little bit too much on what happens outside the field. That hence the word politics in the course descriptions is omnipresent. It's as if we're trying to, you know, legitimize what we're doing. You know, it's not a soft a social science; it's a hard social science because we got politics. But actually, the reason why people go to soccer matches and why people are interested in soccer and why they follow it is because of what happens on the field in most cases, despite reality television and despite the tabloids. And I think it is important to give fans their due as well. And by focusing on the technical aspect of the game, you can bring in sort of the agency of crowds, you know. And for example, Bob Edelman's book on Spartak, you see this very nicely in a very oppressive society, you know, how, you know, fans could influence the way teams played simply by, you know, being enamored with a particular ideal of the short passing continental game versus the kind of very physical up-tempo pace that, say, that the teams of the establishment of the of Dinamo preferred. I think the aesthetics of the game are important because that's how you bring the crowds in. Also, in terms of literature, you know, a lot of football is literature. Sports reporting is, in a way, a form of literature. And a lot of what happens in sports reporting is, you know, reporting on the styles of play. And then, also the players themselves, what they bring to the game. And I was very influenced by C.L.R. James' Beyond the Boundary when I started out. And, talking about sport as art and the actual physical motions that take place on the field are ones that are deeply, deeply artistic. And so, I try to do this. I saw that somebody was using Jonathan Wilson's Inverting the Pyramid. I think it may have been Stephen. And one of my questions was, how did that book work for you? Because I've thought of using it in my course. And also, we've thought of doing it for a football scholars forum. So I'll bounce it back out to anyone who wants to chip in here.
It's Tom, and I used two chapters in that summer course from Wilson, History of Soccer Tactics. And, you know, we looked at the chapter Waltz and Tango, and then Fascism in Killing the Coffee House. And it was designed that day to go out of the classroom and onto the university soccer field and have part lecture, part walkthrough from a tactical end. But it was 115 degrees on the turf that day. So I showed some mercy and we did it inside. But, you know, through looking at tactics, you can not only talk about formations and the evolution of that, but I always found it useful to talk about space. And this goes nicely with, you know, different peoples and how they view space, the Dutch being a classic example in Winner's book. So you can start to tie, you know, a bunch of these different playing styles and how they use space on the field. And my idea was to just walk through it and show people, the neophytes as well as the accomplished players in the group. And it was a group of up to close to 30. It would have been a lot of fun, but it was just too hot that day. But, you know, using Wilson worked really well. And then some students referred back to that book when they were writing their final paper because it was so good.
To comment on Martha's question about how to integrate the technical aspects of the game with the social dimension, maybe David Goldblatt can address Tom's question about how to integrate his book into a history class.
Okay. Hello, all. It's interesting you should ask me that question because that's exactly what I'm thinking about at the moment. I'm arriving in California in mid-December, and I'll be teaching a course on the history of world football at PITSA. And so this is precisely the issue that I'm thinking about. I think it depends partly what your audience is. You know, this my course is going to be very unabashed take on world history, rather than a political economy course or a media course or a sociology course. First and foremost, it's a history of the modern world course. And so the ball is round and, you know, it's kind of set up chronologically to deal with that. What I'm finding is that if I just ask people to go sort of straight through it, it's an awful lot of reading and it's a relentless amount of chronology and narrative. And while that's all very good, you know, you can have too much of a good thing. So I'm trying to find ways of thinning down what I've got and then filling those spaces with topics and issues that cut across regions and cut across time. So just as Peter was saying earlier, the issue of crowds, crowd culture and collective action and identity is something that cuts across all of the different regions covered in the book. So I'm going to do some of that. Similarly, film culture, architecture in the stadium, tactics, strategy, and the notion of distinctive playing styles and national cultures are all topics that are cutting across it. So I'm taking the best out of it, thinning it down, and then providing some light relief from the narrative. And if I may ask everyone who's out there, I'm really interested to know what sort of level of historical knowledge I should reasonably expect from my undergraduate students. What are they coming to a course like this with? Do they know the Cold War? Does the First World War register on their radar? I've just got no idea. So I'd really love to know from you what you think.
Anyone want to take a stab at that and help David out?
Yes, this is Alon Raab. Hi. I think the level of knowledge of history and culture is pretty poor these days. The Cold War, maybe, you know, Hitler or somebody heard about, but Stalin, Freud, you know, that's something unknown to a lot of students. And that indeed is a big challenge in the classes I've been teaching, which have been at large state schools, Portland State University, University of Oregon, and University of California, Davis. So that really is a big challenge. And accompanied with that is the lack of knowledge, of course, about soccer history. So I guess I'll add now my 5 minutes or 90 seconds.
Absolutely. Yeah. You and so, David both, if you would like to probably keep it under 5 minutes, but...
Yeah, I'll try 90 seconds. basically, I've been teaching three different kinds of classes about the game, and each one has a different kind of focus and audience. One is called the Sociology of Soccer Football, and in that class... sort of more theoretical materials, more academic studies, you know, using the British Journal of Sociology and so forth, soccer and society. There's also some smattering of films and literature and that. So that's one kind of class. And then I've also been teaching a class which I send the syllabus. And that class is extremely challenging to come up with the materials because there's so much. And I guess the goal over there is to show the richness of the game, its appearance in different cultures, the connections to class, race, gender. The goals are modest. I also, besides what I just said, I also say that Our goals are to learn about the game's history and culture, study several of its aspects. We will bring to the task the artistry of George Best dribble, the precision of a Maradona free kick, and treat it with the same loving care that Zinedine Zidane employs when distributing the ball. So the idea is also to have a critical lens, but of course with a sense of fun and wonder. And then the third class, even though it's not only about soccer, is a class I just taught last year, Sport and Society in the Middle East. And over there, you know, we deal with Iranian wrestlers and with archery and so forth, but a major part of it is about the game of football. And in that class, I find that because of the lack of knowledge and general bias about the Middle East, I have to spend time and provide materials that are not only about the sports, but also about the things described. So we're talking about Iranian football players. I have to provide some articles about women in the Middle East. But in my classes, an important part are the guests, which I could talk about later, using films and literature. And the most important thing is the game we have at the beginning of the class, the first day, and also the last day of class. And I tell the students that their performance in the game will determine the grade for the class, and also offer them the possibility of facing me. I'll be the goalie. If they score a couple of goals, they'll get an A. If they don't, then they get an F. And I'm being facetious, by the way. But and so that's in, I guess, more than 90 seconds, 108. So anyway, but that's in a nutshell.
Okay, David Kilpatrick, would you like to chime in?
Sure, yeah.
A philosopher.
Yeah, in the philosophy of sport course that I teach, it's broken down into modules, like metaphysics, epistemology. Ethics is a real big area, obviously, in philosophy of sport. Aesthetics can be a little bit trickier, trying to think of sport and art and sport as. So one thing I do is I take Aristotle's Poetics and his notion of the constituent elements, plot, characterization, sound, spectacle, and theme or thought. And I take those constituent elements and apply them to a sporting event. So what I do is I take a video of New York Red Bulls versus Los Angeles Galaxy game that was played in August of 2007. This is kind of useful in terms of thinking about characterization. For it was the game where about 60,000 people welcomed David Beckham to see him play his first game in Major League Soccer. Sadly, we haven't seen the last game by Beckham in Major League Soccer, but I think that's coming soon. That's supposed to be a joke. So, but I guess I can't keep people laughing, I guess. But as we watch the entire game on DVD and analyze it in terms of the plot or sequence of events, characterization, the different players or agents of action, we look at the setting, the time and place of the event, look at the sounds, the songs that are sung, the chants that are sung by the audience, we look at the overall thematic content or the issues that are at stake in the game. Such an event like that was, to what degree can the global game catch on in New York? That's one of the things a lot of the students talk about in relation to that particular game. That seemed to be the stakes involved with that particular game. That particular game is fun to watch because it ended 5-4, and it with the lead exchanging throughout, the home team, New York, winning in right at the very end of the 90 minutes, winning 5-4. So it's compelling viewing all the way through, and it does get the students to think about these issues. Now, I don't then force them to analyze another soccer game. This is to take a sporting event that they've either as athletes themselves or witnessed as spectators and use those same constituent elements of Aristotle's Poetics to apply it to a sporting event. But that's that takes a 1 3-hour class in the philosophy of sport class that I teach.
Great, thank you. Does anyone have questions for Alon or David?
Peter, I have a follow-up for Dave and a question for Alon. Dave, be prepared, actually, since it's your first teaching experience in the United States. A lot of students will show up and they would expect an easy grade. You know, they would expect just a nice soccer talk, what happened in MLS, what happened in EPL. And a lot of them will be scared. That's usually the case in my course when they see that they have five books to read and they have to work on a regular basis. So there are students that are very motivated, and there are some others that, that are expecting just an easy grade. I don't know about other people and their experiences in their classroom, but that was, you know, mine at Tufts and UMass Law. And I also have a question for Alon. Alon, have you seen the movie After the Cup, Sounds of Sakin United? And I'm badly looking for this movie. I would love to see it. I haven't been able to find it. And please help me. If somebody has it, send me a copy.
Well, there are a couple of games about Sakhnin. There are about like five games about them. I think I might have a copy of it. I have a copy of about four of them, so I'll check and see if that's one of them. After a while, all of them kind of merge in my head into one big game. So.
Okay. It's a documentary that was recently made, and I'm very interested. I wasn't able to locate it. It hasn't been out on DVD.
Okay, so should we open it up to also folks who are part of this conversation who have not had a chance to contribute? Anybody, even locally here?
Yeah, I do have a question. This is Alejandro Gonzalez. And, well, actually, I took the class with Peter. And one thing that, he included some popular culture in the sense that he included Nick Hornby, the name. And I was wondering if anyone else used any other cultural or literary materials besides movies. And because, I mean, from what I'm hearing, we're you know, paying a lot of attention to film especially. So I was wondering if anyone else used something else, and how did it work, and yeah, some experiences that you had.
Okay, hi again.
Is everyone still with us?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'm back.
Okay, did Alejandro's question make it through?
Yeah, can I answer that? Sure, Sean.
Go, Sean, yes.
Yeah, I mean, what we've done is to, and this kind of relates to sort of issues also about how do you teach sort of the technical part of football to people who, with few exceptions, this is their first kind of exposure to football. So, like, if you're a geek or and you link that often, you know, like issues around national cultures and so on to, or styles of play, or then it's very hard to sort of bombard them with that kind of information. So what we've done is we use a lot of video. And if there's some great goal or, you know, 1970s Brazil or Argentina, I think it was against Serbia in 2006, that move I can't remember how many passes they took or something like that, then we would show that, or we'd show, you know, Eusebio, and we describe the position. And so they start to get used to thinking about the technical part of the game. The other thing we do is we use a lot of kind of literary, and I think I'm going to probably use more of that in the future, sort of like that book, I think, came out in 2006 when there was a number of writers who go to different countries and write about football. And we use some of that. I'm trying to remember the editor of that. It was like an edited book. I think in future we'll probably also use Chimurenga published a Peter had an essay in that issue on football. We also, you know, music video is definitely something that you can add to it. And then there's been a lot of writers like the famous Turkish writer, Orhan Palmut, or some of the German writers have written about football. And I think if I do this again, I definitely would. I mean, I have a media-centered course, and I definitely will include more of that.
And if I could just add, Alon and John Turnbull and Tom Satterley's book, The Global Game, Writers
that's
on
the book. Yeah.
That's a great one to cannibalize from as well.
Right, that's the book that we've taken a few essays out of, yeah.
I mean, Nick Hornby works really well. I have yet to see it fail. I used it in South Africa when I taught this course in the first part of 2010, building up to the World Cup, and students loved it there. The American students really enjoyed it. It's sure to please. And it's also a nice break from reading the dense academic texts. You know, if you've gone through several weeks of reading 200, 300 page monographs with lots of footnotes, the students love to read something as enjoyable and emotional as Fever Pitch. And what's also nice is that it allows you to talk about club football as being more important than World Cup football, which I think is something that tends to be underplayed. So it's something that I've used and will certainly use again. And it's cheap, it's in paperback, it's easily available. I think it's a sure winner.
Thank you, Peter, for the plug for the book. Just back to your question about the film. Yeah, I have a copy of it. I know it as under a different name. But there's actually a much better film about Sakhnin directed by a Palestinian filmmaker who's a citizen of Israel, Sua Araf, and I have a copy of that. I interviewed her last year, so I'll be happy to send it to you. Since we mentioned film, the use of film, when I started teaching this class about 10 years ago, I relied mostly on written materials, academic studies, and also some documentaries and some narrative films. The last few years I've used the series The Beautiful Game, which I find has a lot of wonderful materials. And of course, nowadays on YouTube, there's so many interesting materials, and a lot of them I actually send the students so they could watch it at home. And I've tried, one of my goals is to really have materials from all over the world. So definitely use the film The Cup about Bhutan. There's an interesting Czech short film by an animator, Svankmajer, called Manly Games, which is a surrealistic treatment of fans. One of the challenges for me has actually been there are too many materials. There are studies, I've used studies about the game in the deaf community. You know, and I mean, there's so much material, and that's been a major challenge for me, actually. Where, what to cut out, what to narrow down.
Hi, I have a question.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi. So I'll be teaching a course. I'm an anthropologist, and it will be looking at globalization, but through sort of race, nation, gender, sexuality. And since I'm a Latin Americanist, a lot of my materials from there, I wanted to ask, how does Galeano go over in non-Latin Americanist audiences? And then just generally, has anyone used the book Soccer versus the State in a class?
We used Galeano, little bits of Galeano in Peter's course. And, there was not a Latin Americanist undergrad in that course. There was other than Alejandro and myself. But this is Alex speaking here. But I think Galeano needs to be taught with a little bit of context to just sort of introduce the little nuggets that he gives you. I think assigning Galeano as a book might be problematic, especially if you have specific themes that you want to focus on in that course. But if you took the time to really sort of cut out pieces of it and, you know, have either little 3-minute lecture introductions or even worksheets to hand out with those excerpts from the book. I think it's a really strong source to connect people to some of the things that we struggle to express about Latin America with sort of drier sources. So I definitely plan on incorporating Galeano into my courses in the future. So I would definitely endorse him.
Yeah, I once taught a class, it's Peter again, where I used in a very kind of cheeky way Galeano as our Bible, or as our Torah, or as our Quran, as our sacred book, our guide, and I would begin class with a reading from the book of Galeano, and then we would end class from another reading from the Gospel of Eduardo, and it worked pretty well. But I think using it as a textbook, it would be quite a challenge. But if you want to bring out the emotional aspect of the game and the poetic aspect of the game and really explain to American students who know little about soccer cultures outside of their suburb, perhaps, I can't think of a better book to expose them to.
Okay, great. And the
I've taught many times with Galeano, and it reminds me of a Texas Tornado lyric. Spanish is a loving tongue, but she never spoke Spanish to me. And I always had some native speakers, native Spanish speakers in there, so I'd ask at least one or two of them to get a copy of the book in Spanish and read to the rest of us so we could look at it side by side, both in English and in Spanish, and it worked well.
Did you have another question, Melissa, that you were going to
ask? I was going to say, great, thanks for that. That really helps me with the Galeano. Has anyone used that new-ish book, Soccer Versus the State, by Gabriel Kuhn?
I like the book, but I haven't. And the earlier work of the writer, he has a really nice pamphlet about anarchism in soccer, but I haven't used the book yet. But if you're interested in, focus on Latin America, definitely the book by the guest in this program last month about Chile, I thought was a fantastic book to use. And also there's a really nice syllabus called Soccer and Society in Modern Latin America that's a class that Carlos Aguirre at the University of Oregon teaches. And I thought his choice of materials were really outstanding. It's you could just go to, Soccer and Society in Modern Latin America, Carlos Aguirre, and you'll find it. I think that you'll find a lot of excellent suggestions over there also.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the recording for Brenda Elsie's session got a little messed up, but you can, the MP3 still is on the website. And we also had a session on Roger Magazine's Golden and Blue Like My Heart, which is about Pumas fans. I'm not familiar with Gabriel Kuhn's book.
And the Spanish session with our friends from Buenos Aires.
Yes, of course. Yeah, there's also an MP3 worth checking out from a few months back on Julio Friedenberg and Rodrigo Nascar's edited volume. I'm not sure if you're able to assign anything in Spanish in the class, but there's definitely some great chapters in that book that are accessible enough in what they try and sort of bite off and chew. So all three of those have our discussions. So I'm actually quite happy that we can start doing that, start pointing people to the archive, the Football Scholar Swarm. So I think those are worth checking out. But Brenda's book is especially accessible and also lends itself to being cut up by chapter. So I think in all of these courses, we're very sort of liberal in our willingness to cut up these books, and sometimes it works, but sometimes it doesn't. But I think Brenda's is one that definitely lends itself to that.
Great, thanks a lot.
I had a question. This is Graham. I'm a new person to the group. At the mention of the word archive as an archivist, and also in relation to Kuhn's book, which I find to be very sort of multi-media, there's everything from snippets of posters to interviews, oral histories, all sorts of different archival records. I'm wondering if anyone has used, archival institutions or informal archives, community groups, records, to direct students for their papers relating to soccer history.
Yeah, and maybe if you could just give us 10 words, since you're new, about where you are and your interests, and you mentioned you're an archivist.
Yeah, I'm an MA student at the University of Manitoba. I did archives for the Vancouver Whitecaps FC this summer, And yeah, just generally sort of interested in leftist politics, soccer, globalization, that sort of stuff, and how it can be sort of empowered through the use of the archive.
Yeah, great question. Does anyone have any explicit use of archives in their courses?
Alex, may I mention a few things? This is Steven again.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go for it.
As Tony Mason mentioned it, we soccer historians are crippled because there isn't a lot of archives about soccer, especially in American soccer. And I was very sad when I recently figured out about the archives of the National Soccer Hall of Fame. Actually, the institution had to close down. And the archives are actually somewhere in South Carolina or North Carolina. I'm not sure. They moved them to storage, which has AC, but nobody has access because I think it needs to go since it was a Soccer Hall of Fame institution. They need to go through the Attorney General of New York, the Secretary of Education, and things like that. And those guys, they did a pretty poor job, actually. Things were not really cataloged. We don't really know what is inside, actually. That's the problem. And I've located some stuff at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. They actually have quite a few things on Laza. Laza was a Portuguese league that was very strong in the 70s and the 80s. And I also have a meeting next week with the New England Soccer Hall of Fame. They have quite a few pictures. They have about 300-400 pictures. They have soccer programs, brochures. They have some folders with newspaper clippings. And I'm trying to arrange actually to move the stuff to UMass Amherst. And the director of archives there, he's very interested to get these materials and to make a permanent home for them. So that was it. I just wanted to throw this.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anyone else, I'm not sure of your interest, Graham, but the only experience with online archives that are related to my research is that the Football Association in Argentina has digitized a series of regulations and annual memories and balances for the 40s and 50s. They spent a lot of money on professionals to kind of come in and digitize these sources, and then the plug was pulled on it as part of one of the many great decisions by Julio Grondona. But if you Google the Asociación del Fútbol Argentino's Biblioteca, you'll find these really well done digitizations of, I'd say, about 80 bound sources that they have, but that's the only experience I have from my research, and I'm not sure how I would assign those or expose those to undergraduates.
Great, thanks very much.
Yeah, I'm not sure if anyone else has any experience with the science. It's a great question. I mean, if we want to direct students to primary sources on football, where do we send them?
And I found that even undergraduate, I mean, it shouldn't be too early to send people to the archives, but so many history students are only taught from secondary sources and not encouraged to go to the archives. So maybe it would have to be the upper level courses that can use these resources, I guess, comprehensively.
Well, I suppose, I mean, the way I've always thought about it with that problem is that you know, I'm thinking of when I teach a methods course here eventually that I'd like to include some of my own primary sources in the class. Just have, you know, like a dozen really juicy ones that I translate into English and expose to the undergraduates as primary sources for very focused, you know, not for their end of the semester research projects, but for a research exercise that they would be able to sort of get into those primary sources. You know, I'm working with Spanish sources, but I'm not sure if that strikes anyone else as a good idea to, I know Peter did the same thing in his course. We had some primary sources in the form of correspondence between, Stanley Rouse and, SAFA, no?
South African Football Association. Yeah.
But those are the only experiences I've had and the only thoughts I've really given to giving primary sources to the undergrads in a way that's, you know, focused and neat.
Yeah, there are three major kinds of primary sources that my students have tended to use for their research papers. The most difficult to get access to are the government documents that are not in English. For being in North America, that's a huge, huge obstacle and one that most students can't get around. Club records, sometimes they are lucky enough to get access to. In South Africa, the club records have not been maintained at all. And in most cases, the black football clubs until the early 1990s had very good reasons not to keep detailed records, given the harassment and surveillance that they were subjected to by the apartheid state. But in some cases, it was just poor preservation. So that's a huge obstacle in Africa. The third kind of source is the newspaper source, and we've had much more success with newspapers. And the availability of newspapers online has really opened up a whole new range of possibilities. And in Spanish and in English, and I know in Portuguese and many other languages. And now if you're based at a university, you have access to databases that have newspapers going back to the late 19th century at least. So those are wonderful sources, but again, you get a very partial view. Now there's Ikabo Chipande here who has done research in the Zambian archives, who wants to share a little bit of his thoughts on what it was like to do a master's thesis on Zambian football in the archives in Lusaka.
That was actually very interesting, and I'm very interested in this discussion of archives, especially. With what I've heard, like some national football associations that have made their own archives. In the Zambian situation, as Professor Alec indicated, there is a challenge in the sense that the football association or the national federations or the sports actually are not consistent with the keeping of the records. And the only primary sources that one can find is in the National Archives. And that is where one would find primarily the written sources like old newspapers from the colonial era up to almost the later, up to current, I can say. So, but the challenge also, of course, in our context is that even there, the state in which the material is being kept is not very good. And I'm interested in this because then my hope is that sometime when I go back home, possibly I'll influence the setting of Akçalan archive within the national federations.
That would be fantastic.
Students in my classes have not used primary sources from archives, but when the focus in my class is more on sociology, one of the projects is to write a paper about an aspect of the local soccer culture. And students have focused on everything from... Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, okay, sorry. I heard a phone ring, so... So students are focused on fans of Portland, the Timbers Army. Somebody wrote a really interesting paper that later he turned into a master's thesis, spending a lot of time interviewing the fans and actually being very involved with that particular group of fans. Other students focused on groups of immigrants from different countries. Somebody wrote an interesting paper about Somalis in Portland that... you know, football is a really important part of their social network. So that, and I find that kind of research, and then, of course, they also have to look at the, you know, some of the literature, the academic literature that relates to group of immigrants in the game or other groups has been very interesting for the students. In another class, I also, one of the projects is to write about fanzines and have the students contact the authors of the fanzines, compare them, talk to them, and you know, through the internet or Skype or whatever. And that has also been really interesting for the students, and I think very beneficial.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's a few people who haven't had the chance to ask any questions. I'm not sure if Chris or Andrew or Susan have anything they'd like to chip in with.
Hello. James.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, everybody. It's Chris Boltzmann in Birmingham in the UK. I teach a second year sociology course called Sport, Politics and Culture. And my concern is I have not been able to attract female students to the course. And I'm concerned that it's the rather than politics and culture that's in the title that's putting female students off, but rather it's sport that's putting female students off. And the first question I ask my students in that lecture or in that course is, what is the number one football team in the world? And of course, everybody turns around and says Spain. And I then suggest it's a different team. And then, of course, talk about who is the best footballer in the world. And when I tell them it's Marta da Silva, they're all quite surprised. But my question is really, how do we attract students to these courses who may not be interested in sport per se, but will hopefully by the end of attending a module like this or a course like this may actually then have some interest in such courses? I'll switch off.
Yeah, and I think Chris's question really lends itself to maybe sort of linking to one of the questions that we asked, that we circulated beforehand, which is, even once you, if you're able to attract sort of a diverse student body to your courses, how do you then manage that student body in the course, especially if you have, you know, I imagine a lot of you have spoken about how you open class in different ways. And, you know, if we talk about the Man City Man U game at the start of class, and, you know, you have three people who are very much, you know, following that scene and are very engaged with that, you might have 15 that have no idea. So I think Chris's question, maybe we can talk first how to form that kind of a body that we're looking for of students in the classes, and then if we get them, how do we manage everyone's expectations and goals for the class? No.
Yeah, I'm Susan. Hi.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, this is Susan. So since I didn't speak yet, I thought maybe I could even reply to that question. I'm talking from Switzerland, from Basel, and I've taught three different courses on sports in Africa. Two in Germany and one in Switzerland. So I had good experience with one course, which was called Sports, Gender and Politics in Africa. I put the gender in the title to get funding. And the good thing was that I got very good female students also in the course who did not know anything of soccer or sports or anything, but who became almost the best students in the class, I think, because they were more interested really in reading, to know more. I think sometimes the problems with all these kind of huge sports fans is, of course, that they think it's more an easy course, they don't need to read, and so on. So in my class, which I taught in Basel, we had the problem. We had 30 men and only two female students, but again, the two female became the best. And they did really very good research papers also. That's maybe something linking to the primary sources. There was one student, she did then a paper on the Africa tour from the national Swiss team in 1982, the first tour to Africa from Switzerland. And it was interesting. She did not get any access to the Football Federation in Switzerland, but she had access to some of the people who participated in the tour and also to newspapers again. Yes, it might be. I had something. Oh, yeah, something else I wanted to add before, because I think Marta raised this question of how do we enter experience from the pitch into the class. And I wanted just to mention, I don't know if any one of you reads German, but the University of Zurich in 2008, maybe you may remember, there was a European Cup in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And the University of Zurich, they prepared a kind of dossier, a paper with academics writing on how to enter football, how to call it, set pieces. Is this a standard situation? Set piece? You say set piece? Okay. So how you enter a set piece into didactics, into the classroom? How to teach with set pieces? So kind of, yes, you have the corner and all these kind of things. And how do you use that in class? So there's a number of nice reflections on how to use that in class.
May I follow up? This is Stephen again with Susan and Chris. Chris, I enjoyed your presentation, by the way, in London on Corinthians. Couple of months ago during the conference. Nice paper. Chris, I would like to share my experience. I've actually more and more female students during the first course. I only had two.
This is Martha. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe until Stephen comes back, I just have another comment on when I taught my course in 2004 about the students. And what I found was that European students and students that had foreign experience were much better students in the class. Of course, my class was on development worldwide, but there was more of an acceptance of seeing sports sociologically. And maybe it was my bias. I don't know. But in addition to the gender bias, I think, sometimes students that have foreign experiences seem to have a broader understanding of sport.
I think I got cut off.
Ah, there you are, Stephen.
This is Stephen. I apologize. It was my internet connection. So I don't know where I got cut off. I was saying that I have more and more female students, and some of them are some of my best students. I wanted to share something with you. Last week, I was in the subway, and next to me, it was Angela Huclis. She's a World Cup champion. She's an Olympic champion, and she was not recognized. And that was the D line, the green line. And there are a lot of female BC students, BU students. In which other country will be riding next to a World Cup champion, an Olympic champion, and the person will be completely unrecognized? So that was a nice observation. I wanted to share it with you.
But maybe if it had been Hope Solo or Abby Wambach, it wouldn't have been true.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, there are a lot of American male players who wouldn't get recognized on the D-line either. just to follow up on Suzanne and Martha's points, I also found that my women students tended to be better than my male students. I'm not sure why. I think because a lot of male students in college undergraduates think they can get by just getting B's, you know, whereas a lot of women take their studies seriously and do a heck of a lot better as a result. But also it is true what Martha said about, at least for the American students who had experiences overseas, they were much more engaged. And that led to not only participation in class, which was informed and timely and consistent, but also much more involvement in their research, in the process, and in the final product. So two of the female students who had recent travel abroad experiences, one had been in Ireland during the World Cup, and Ireland, of course, was not in the 2010 World Cup thanks to the hand of Gaul. But the other woman had been in Spain, and you couldn't have picked a better country to be in. And so she happily circulated pictures of her dancing on the bar top there the night of, was it July 11th, 2010, right? And she did a great paper on sort of internal nationalisms, Catalonian nationalism and Basque nationalism and their relationship to football nationalism. And really great stuff. So that has also been my experience, that at least for the American students that have traveled overseas, they're much more in tune with the importance of football, and that tends to translate, at least for the female students, into really good performances.
Well, go ahead.
I was going to make a point about the female students, too. The other thing that I find that's interesting is there's a disconnect, because in the U.S., certainly most of the young women I know play the game but aren't fans in the same way and don't follow it in the same way. And the men who do know the game tend to follow it as fans more. So there's ways of bringing them in by sort of trying to get them to talk about their playing experiences and why there might be a disconnect. through the way that sports are gendered and prestige and privilege are gendered in the U.S.? I mean, I find that that's gotten them to talk more.
Mm-hmm. Well, in my classes, actually, I think it was always a pretty even number of male and female students, sometimes even more women. And maybe it's because I've taught at university towns where many women play the game and at the university level and in general. One thing that maybe ties a little bit to the question of how to get the students interested is, for me, in all my classes, you know, connecting it to their own lives, their own concerns. And one way to approach that is also, I think, through the guests that I try to bring in class. I find that, you know, we could read materials, we could watch movies, we could play, which, of course, is important. But actually having people who are connected to the game in a very personal and unique way is really attracts students and interests them. So I've had, for example, Jimmy Conway, who was played for Fulham in the 60s, was on the Irish national team, played for the Portland Timbers. And it was just such a wonderful storyteller, had amazing stories about playing with Rodney Marsh, George Best. And I find that that kind of hearing about people's experiences with the game, the way he described growing up in Belfast and, you know, poverty, the first time he went across the channel, the ocean, the Irish Sea, to get and play for Fulham. I mean, it's something that students really relate to. The same thing I always try to bring, if I teach in Portland, the University of Portland, of course, has a very strong women's team. So I've had coaches, I've had players. I've had a friend, Paul Goodrich, who's the head of African Sports Outreach, and he started a couple of football academies in Ghana and Togo. And, you know, it's that kind of personal experience that I find students relate to extremely well. I also brought, since in Portland, Nike and Adidas have their headquarters, invited people from Nike to talk about their marketing, but I also invited anti-sweatshop activists to talk about the other side of the ball, so to speak. So I think, you know, and one thing we didn't, those are some of the ways I find helpful for me in my teaching.
It's approximately 3:35 here in East Lansing. I think we probably should try and start bringing the conversation to a close, let's say, for another 10 to 15 minutes. Are there other questions that people have, particularly from those who have been listening in who have not had a chance to contribute?
This is Andrew Guest. I'm one of those who's been listening in, enjoying the conversation, and appreciating everybody's perspectives. I actually teach at the University of Portland that Alan was just referring to as a good soccer school, but it's a small school that has a fairly conventional kind of liberal arts curriculum, and there's not a lot of room for kind of creative classes. I was actually a guest speaker for Elon once too about sports and development stuff, but just once. I think didn't make the highlight reel. I just wanted to chime in just since I had been listening and enjoying the conversation. Any class I have a chance to teach is really more sort of general, sports theme. I think getting down to the soccer piece is too specific. So that is one question that's crossed my mind is, you know, why do soccer specifically as opposed to a broader sports class? And then the other piece that does interest me is the piece of that came up earlier, which is, you know, how to convince people that it's worthwhile. And I noticed on all the syllabi that people did have, you know, the sort of conventional syllabi speak about critical thinking and writing skills and all that kind of stuff. And I guess I am a little curious just how seriously people take that. Like, is using soccer a chance to teach other academic skills or disciplinary skills? Is that how you approach it? Or is it my sense, and I think because we're all sort of interested in football, is that people are really interested in teaching about football, and that those other pieces, you know, if they happen, that's great. But I think I would have a tough time convincing my curriculum committee and things that that we'd be able to do it. And from what I heard people saying, it sounds like often it's a matter of you know, if people are predisposed anyway, you can do it. But if they're not predisposed, I don't know, unless anybody's been able to actually convince people. But I'll mute myself again. That was more than I intended to say.
You don't want to take a stab at Andrew's provocative questions?
I'll tackle that. David Kilpatrick here. I think it's a really interesting question to raise, but I think to get a course on sport through a curriculum committee, you've got to justify it using those kinds of terms. Otherwise, you don't have a shot. I didn't do a specific course. Again, mine was philosophy of sport and within a humanities department. I teach English and philosophy, but I've also taught sport management courses before. I think that's, you know, some of the points raised before by Martha about types of students and things like that. Also, it really depends on if this is an elective course, gen ed requirements, or if this is an upper level course for a major or even a graduate level course. But I think to get any course on sport through any curriculum committee, there is a lot of prejudice against sport courses. Unless you're in a department of kinesiology, of course, and you have to justify it and be able to explain how you'll address critical thinking, how you'll incorporate writing assignments, those kinds of things, and give very clear evidence as to how what your assignments will be, that those kind of core competencies in those different areas will be addressed.
That's a good point, David. I mean, Andrew, I'll play sort of devil's advocate here. It seems to me that, why shouldn't soccer enhance analytical skills, critical thinking, and research skills, etc.? I mean, I'm not quite sure why you're so skeptical. After all, there are plenty of courses on music. There are courses on fashion, there are courses on all sorts of things that have moved beyond sort of, at least in history, yeah, which is the only discipline I can say anything remotely intelligent on, war and diplomacy and sort of, the old-fashioned political history or even economic history that a lot of people still think is the only legitimate history around there. So I don't know. I mean, basically I say, look, here's my syllabus. If anyone's going to write a 20 to 25 page research paper, and Alex Galarza and Alejandro Gonzalez were in that class, they know what, I can be a real stickler for these things. And you show up with 4 secondary sources and 2 web-based newspaper sources, you're going to fail my class. That's how I teach research skills. That's where I bring in, the use of various electronic databases, the importance of primary sources. My first class, you meet in the library. We have a library instruction session where these students learn how to use many of these amazing digital and conventional resources at their disposal. That's how I sell it to my colleagues. And frankly, I've been lucky. I haven't really had to sell it because it's framed, as I said in my remarks at the beginning, as any other serious university course. I'm not looking to teach a lighthearted class. I'm also not wanting to teach a boring, stultifying, uninspiring class. So, when I ask people to do an oral presentation, I expect the notes to be sharp. I expect discussion leaders to present handouts to everybody. They're sometimes I do oral history projects. So there are a whole number of ways that, in concrete, specific ways, people practice those skills. Now, obviously, some are going to take it more seriously than others, and success is always happenstance. Unfortunately, there's only so much we can control. But I definitely think that soccer, a soccer-based humanities or social science course can do that if it's well organized, if you're fortunate that you have a good mix of students, and the material is inspiring. And I also teach a global sport class because I'm also interested in other things like boxing and cycling and other things. So I do mix this 487 seminar up, and I have taught it as a sport class with books on the Tour de France, the Nazi games of 1936, and a whole bunch of other stuff, sexuality and gender, Susan Kahn's book. So, soccer allows us to narrow the scope just a little bit. But I'm also struck that so many of us have taken a global approach to soccer, because there, I think it's perfectly legitimate to say that we could do a whole course on soccer in one city or one nation or one continent, and yet so many of us have taken the global approach, and I thought it would be interesting to just highlight that.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I didn't mean to come off as too skeptical. I think this is true of most good courses. I mean, I think people get interested in teaching subjects because they find the subjects themselves really interesting, and then they also hope that there's going to be some other academic and intellectual skills that come along with those courses. So I didn't mean to suggest there was anything particular about this, and I certainly, again, was impressed with the syllabi that were put up on the online, and that looked like a lot of classes I'd love to take. I was just curious how people approach that in terms of thinking, approaching their courses with the idea of, I'm really just using soccer to try to teach some other academic, disciplinary, intellectual skills, or, I hope they get some academic, disciplinary, intellectual skills, but I'm really interested in talking about soccer from a academic perspective. And it's sort of a subtle distinction, but I didn't mean to be skeptical of the potential.
Skepticism
outcomes.
Is good, Andrew.
No, that's true. Okay. I meant to be constructively skeptical, then let me say that.
I think that one of the wonderful things about teaching these kind of classes, and I also teach a class on history and culture of the bicycle, which is my other religion, is that so many people have, wonderful, I mean, you do get students who never play the game, don't know much about it, but you get also a lot that, have such wonderful memories of cycling, of playing the game, and those memories are stored in their bodies in a really powerful way. And I think that, and this, of course, is a different discussion about why we're teaching in general, not only these particular classes, but why are we teaching in general, besides the fact that maybe we don't want to flip burgers at McDonald's. And I think with teaching these kind of classes, it's really a wonderful opportunity to look at so many aspects of culture and the world, and connect them to students' lives. And having something they care about and love is a really, wonderful gateway.
Yeah, well put, Alon.
I just want to say my first statement was about the ignorance of American students, and I'm sorry if I gave the impression that there aren't wonderful students who know, more history and culture than I'll ever know. But it is a little disappointing that so many students, unfortunately, do not know what came before us,
Yeah, unfortunately, David Gulbaris, are you still there, David? No, I think he took off. But I was going to say, my biggest challenge in using the ball is round, both in South Africa and here in the United States, has been precisely that, Alon, the fact that students don't know the basics about the Cold War, the students don't know the basics about Latin America or Africa, for that matter. And I spent a lot of time doing foundational work in order for them to then be able to really get the most out of David's amazing book. So it was a heck of a lot of work, and disheartening to see that our high schools really are not preparing students for university level work.
Well, hopefully we won't have a president that thinks that Africa is a country. So,
unfortunately, we have a president who is partly African, but apparently American, I'm told.
If I could chime in on that, it's not just a lack of historical knowledge, it's geographic knowledge. And I think that's one of the great things about teaching soccer, is that it does require some kind of geographic awareness, or at least it'll provoke it in students just by looking at a game at the local level, say, the New York Red Bulls versus Los Angeles Galaxy game. That I used in that one aesthetics section of the philosophy of sport course, just looking or the countries that they have some kind of genealogic background to, one thing about the beautiful game is that it is the global game, and it kind of forces students to come to some kind of better geographic awareness. So I think historical ignorance and geographic ignorance go hand in hand.
Any final comments that folks like to share with the group?
Maybe I should just say here from Basel that courses on sports history are very welcome here. So we had, I think, at least four courses on sports, and even on Roman sports in the Roman time, and on the Middle Eastern sports, and yeah, sports history in Africa. So you're all welcome in Basel to teach sports.
That's great. Maybe we can talk about future plans to teach collaboratively, perhaps online, Suzanne, with so many of us doing this kind of work.
This was my question for Suzanne. Do you have guys in Switzerland online courses as we do more and more here in the U.S.? I honestly think that in 5 to 10 years, 50% of the courses will be online.
Yeah, probably not in Basel yet. Maybe at some of the natural science, but not the history department yet. So unfortunately, do not. Maybe at the Zurich University, which is better equipped. But I don't think so. That will come very soon here, because the full kind of how we teach courses is a little bit different. So it might not happen as soon.
Thank you very much. And I just wanted respond to Andrew's question about 20 minutes ago about why teach it, why study it, with a short quote by Swami Yogananda, who's considered one of the people who introduced yoga to the West. And he said, you will be closer to heaven through football than by the Gita. And he didn't mention studying the game and teaching it, but maybe we could extend that statement to our classes as well.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you all.
Ciao. Ciao.